been doing a series here where we've looked at all of these individually, and this week we are at the right action. And of course, there's three parts to right action. And interestingly, if you were to take the right action and the right speech, those two make up the five precepts. So this is layperson ordination when you take the five precepts. Pratimoksha vows. The Pratimoksha vows start off with not to kill. And that's in the right action. Now, not to kill or not to destroy any life. We could be incredibly literal with this, and we could say that you should not murder anything. Most specifically, not to murder people. I mean, that's kind of, you know, I don't think that's too hard to understand. But just like any precept or any practice that we take on, we take them on to whatever specific degree that we are able to at this time. We're not supposed to take on a vow or a precept and assume that we're going to do it at the most deepest, most masterful level. We take them exactly where we're at. So, if all we are capable of in the act of not killing is to refrain from killing another person, that's where we start. That's it. Does that mean that we're not allowed to go hunting or kill a cockroach in our kitchen or something like that? No, we're not discussing that. If for the sake of learning the preciousness of human life, which is where we want to start, because this is all about developing compassion and loving kindness towards other sentient beings. If our understanding of sentient being is purely human, then that's where we start. Stop killing people. And we don't have to go any further. A lot of people seem to think, oh, you become Buddhist, you have to be vegetarian. That's not true. Most Buddhists around Asia are not vegetarian at all. Shakyamuni Buddha himself was not vegetarian. In fact, he ate what anyone would offer, except a cow, because in India they hold that as sacred, so he wouldn't eat that because that's considered a forbidden food. So aside from that, I mean, if somebody gave him lamb or chicken or whatever, he'd eat it. There's no problem with that. In fact, it's very interesting. If you host monastics from the Himalayas, they always tell you, in preparation for their dietary needs, you should stock beef. Usually like strip steak or something like that, because you know they just you want to be able to cut it up and pan fry it, and they eat that. So this idea of being vegetarian, this has nothing to do with the precept against killing. The precept against killing, very specifically, is about murdering another human. But like anything in the Buddhism, we can turn the coin around and then there's a whole deeper facet. No, that still has nothing to do with vegetarianism. Instead, what it has to do with is the way that we harm others in our actions. We can kill the thought, the ideology, the existence of another person without physically creating harm to them. We touched on that in the previous one on speech, where we have abusive words, how we can destroy somebody just with a pen, right? That's the age-old saying, the pen is more powerful than the sword. So you can literally destroy somebody's life without having to execute them. This right action of not destroying a life includes that. So we don't go out and seek a revenge where we destroy somebody financially to where they're in complete ruin and become homeless, thus taking a life. Taking a life is destroying their way of life. Hence, we don't have Buddhist missionaries running around destroying culture. We don't try to convert anyone to Buddhism. In fact, it's usually a little bit more difficult to become Buddhist, especially if you don't know the teacher that you're trying to get refuge vows from. Oftentimes, they'll tell you no. But we don't destroy any aspect of a person's life, and we should, as Buddhists, take this on in our thinking. We have to be very careful when we sever a relationship with somebody. That needs to be done with a great amount of skill and a great amount of wisdom. Especially today in the West, divorce is super common. Now, it's not like it wasn't in the East. It is common in the East. But it was a different entire system. And in fact, there was no taboo against it. There's no problem. In fact, in the native culture that I'm from, getting married is this whole big ceremony. But to get divorced, one of the members in the relationship, whether it's the husband or the wife, simply returns to their parents. That's it. And they say, oh, is this permanent? And the person says, yeah. Okay, that's it. Now they're free to marry again. The taboo comes from other religious influences and such, and has been put on our culture, and so we've taken those on. So we usually refrain from a divorce until it's really, really horrific. And there's all kinds of massive problems, and it becomes a very, very ugly thing. It's usually a ferocious battle with all kinds of, harsh words, heated debates and arguments, lawyers get involved, and then you have the other issue of people just doing things out of spite to harm another. If there's kids involved, it's even worse. So, this not to destroy any life is included in this aspect. Again, if these are too profound concepts and we can't necessarily engage them, our first bet is just to stop killing people. After that, we begin to... In the activity... So when the Buddha says you should refrain from something, it's not that you just blindly stop. You stop and you engage that cessation of the activity with contemplation. Well, why exactly should we stop this? Right? Buddha says you always challenge every teaching of the Buddha. Never believe anything he says. He tells us that. We are not to accept things on faith. You're to accept them, test them, try them out, contemplate them, and then see what kind of result, positive or negative, arises. And if you get a negative result, then you throw that teaching out and you say the Buddha's full of shit. Doesn't matter. But if you get the positive result, then apply it and go deeper. Teach it to others that are interested. Work with it. So the not destroying any life. We decide we're not going to kill anyone anymore. Those in the military, this is very difficult if they become Buddhist while they're in the service, especially if they're in infantry or they're in some kind of organization in the military that is directly involved in conflict. They always have a hard time with this thing. So as you contemplate not killing, you think about why this would be a reasonable thing. And it has nothing to do with law. I mean, sure, you could say, well, yeah, you shouldn't kill because if you get caught, you go to prison. That's not a good excuse to stop killing. I mean, maybe it is for some people, but not spiritually. That's not a decent reason. So as we're contemplating it, we should first think. All sentient beings everywhere want the exact same thing. All of them. They're all equal. In that, every single one of them wants happiness. Because they are not enlightened, they are not sure how to attain that happiness. And because they have misunderstandings or wrong views of what brings happiness, they tend to chase those things that are not entirely helpful. Once they do that, if we, who are also chasing happiness, and we are also unenlightened, come in contact with them, and their views or their actions are opposite of ours, this could cause a conflict. And sometimes that conflict escalates to the point of we need to take them out. And that's easy to do if we don't identify that they also are suffering just like us and looking for happiness and peace and contentment exactly the same way we are. If we can recognize that same human quality, what begins to happen is we want to dialogue. It opens a channel for interpersonal communication. Whoa, so why are you doing that over there? Well, I'm trying to get this. Well, why is it that you want that? Because I perceive it brings happiness if I can own this. And to own it, I have to take it away from you. So now we have dialogue. Well, but you see, in taking this also causes our suffering. Which means we want to retaliate and rebel. So how can we both achieve the same level of happiness without causing misery to each other? And we're dialoguing. We have peace talks taking place. That's how you approach these teachings, such as the vow to not destroy any life. The same goes with stealing. I just brought that up in that example. The same is true with the committing of adultery. The whole aspect behind the right action is to recognize everybody's need for liberation from suffering. And then to work for a universal attainment of that. Now, I'm not talking about trying to develop utopia, because that's ridiculous. In reality, what we have to come to terms with, as the Buddha says, we have to patiently accept the Four Noble Truths. Suffering exists. There is a cause for that suffering. If we understand the cause of the suffering, that means that it can be removed. And the fourth noble truth is the Buddha's specific path that ends that suffering. So how do we do this? Our suffering is generated internally, and the liberation is also generated internally. No amount of property, wealth, land, ownership of anything, including honorific positions and power, none of these things will bring liberation from suffering. If anything, it creates more. Not to sound old, but not too long ago, I was reading an article in the Reader's Digest. Yes, I'm one of those guys that read Reader's Digest. It's like my grandparents used to. I like it. It's a great magazine. They had an article in there about people who were in poverty or in very hard circumstances. You know, that paycheck to paycheck, they call it, right? Which I've been in that almost my entire life, except for in one period of it. But these people had won lotteries. And we're not talking about the $100,000 lotteries. We're talking about they won multiple millions. And in this article, they had gone and they had tracked down these people. They had gotten their backstory, interviewed them, and they did this over time. So from them having become wealthy instantly overnight, and they tracked them for a period of about 5 years in writing the article. All of them, without fail, had the exact same issue. They all of a sudden had all this money. The very thing that they were battling to try and get, that they believed, as soon as they could get that, all their problems and worries would be dissolved. They would have happiness. Or their new problems would not be that big. You know, they said themselves, well, yeah, we thought, you know, we'll get the lottery, all of our financial problems are over, all our big worries are over, and then we'll just be left with real small problems that can be easily handled. And it turned out to be completely opposite from that. In fact, the first couple years were really exciting because they were blowing millions like crazy. They were buying houses that were way too big for them to handle, going on extraordinary expensive trips. And the other thing that they did, all of them did, was they paid for friends and families to come with them. Now we, the poor, would think, well, yeah, that's exactly what I would do. This is a bad idea. In the article, and then they go into in depth on why it's a bad idea. There's other ways to help spread your wealth that the wealthy actually do know how to do. Those that, I guess, grew up with lots of money or something, but, you know, those eternally rich people. but anyhow, they burn through so much money in their first couple years, and so they're kind of in this bliss state. But they basically are ignoring all of the problems that have arisen due to their finances. And they don't pay attention to that, and by the third, fourth, and fifth year, they are nearing bankruptcy. They are nearing all kinds of huge financial problems. And out of, I think they had, if I'm not mistaken, they had like 8 or 10 different families that they were following that had all become millionaires. And every single one of them, there wasn't one left after that 5-year mark that was financially secure. And so they were having all kinds of huge issues. And now they were worse off because now they were terrified in losing that money that they had just gained. So now they're paying all this massive amount of money for specialized lawyers and specialized accountants and people that can invest for them. And so now they're doing this emergency, how do we save the ship kind of thing, and the money keeps going out all these other channels. So we know anything that we chase outside of ourselves, if we think of anything out there, and we think it's going to help, it won't work. It's only a temporary fix. Those of us that had heydays with drugs and alcohol know exactly that. The first couple highs are great, and that's what causes us to go at it more. But then those highs become problematic, either financially, relationship-wise, health-wise, mental-wise. It starts taking its toll. And now it's no longer doing that promise that we thought, which was relieving our suffering. Now it's a huge suffering just to get it. I found it really difficult to keep a job while drinking. Or to function at my job. Hey, you get one of those meetings and you're getting chewed out and all you're thinking is, when can I get my next drink? That's not what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to make me blissfully happy all the time. But it wasn't doing it. And even worse, when you get your high or you get that lovely drunk on and it turns on you, and the demons meet you in your high or in your drunk, it's even worse. So in one of the sutras, there is a fantastic quote. What is not here inside of yourself is not out there in any outer object. And what is within you is exactly what's out there. What that means is if you don't have peace and happiness within yourself, you will not find it in anything out there that will give you any lasting effect. But if you have lasting peace and happiness within yourself, you will be able to find that outside everywhere. Right action includes this. It includes contemplating the activities that you do. The best way to look at the right action, we have this list. Just think of it this way. I'm going to try and refrain from causing any kind of harm to another person and myself because I am a person. And instead of just leaving it there, contemplate why this is a good idea. Well, it's a good idea because we're both trying to find happiness. Okay, so where does that happiness come from? And how would you attain it? You keep having to contemplate and investigate these teachings. This is how we study and apply Dharma. It's also how we come to realize its deepest meaning, which is how we even opened our service today. When we begin to contemplate this way, we begin to think about our actions. The activity of doing right action will actually arise on its own organically. It's not something that we will actively have to do. it'll begin to manifest itself in our actions because we become what we think. So we think and contemplate non-harmful thoughts and where true happiness arises from, and we begin manifesting those activities that lead us to that. So next week, I think we'll look at two of them. We'll look at right livelihood and the right effort, because right livelihood, there's not a whole lot that would need to be said about that. Because it just is kind of the sum of everything that we've looked at so far. And so we'll cover that, and then we'll talk about effort, which is a really big one. People are often afraid of effort. So we'll discuss those two next week. Back to our Sunday service here, and we're going to go into a meditation.